Hello, and welcome to Weekend Programming here on Radio Prague. I'm Jan Bellinger. In today's show, we'll be addressing your comments and questions in a fresh edition of Mailbox. Topics discussed include the end of shortwave and the Sunday music program, and there'll even be criticism from one listener who accuses us of propaganda and being back in the CSSR. Mailbox will be followed by Czech Books with David Vaughan. His guest is Gail Naughton, the head of the National Czech and Slovak Museum and Library in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. And we'll round things out with another edition of From the Archives. Now, though, it's time for Mailbox, and that, of course, is hosted by Pavla Horáková.
Hello and welcome to Mailbox, a program for your views and comments. It's been almost 3 weeks now since Radio Prague left shortwave, and we are still getting emails from you on the subject, such as this one from Jayanta Chakrabarty from India.
January 31st was my wife's birthday, a day to celebrate and rejoice. The day will also be remembered as one of the most disappointing days in my life. Never have I imagined that I would be a witness to this tragic end when a legacy called Radio Prague will be dismantled. As rightly pointed out in the concluding edition of Letter from Prague, a fraction of the crowns that is siphoned off in immoral corruption could have helped to keep Radio Prague healthy and running. We, the ardent admirers and well-wishers of Radio Prague shortwave station, would have much liked to contribute our mite financially to keep Radio Prague running. Can we ever dream of a resurrection of our beloved Radio Prague shortwave in the foreseeable future? Are the authorities listening?
At the moment, as far as shortwave broadcasting is concerned, we have good news, at least for listeners in the southeastern United States. Radio Prague's English and Spanish programs are being rebroadcast on Radio Miami on the frequency 9955. Please see www.wrmie.net for the broadcast schedule. Here's an email from Bob Boundy from New Zealand.
In yesterday's mail, I received my first QSL card, and this made me very pleased indeed, as the QSL card was of Lockett Castle. My wife and I, as well as my Czech friends, visited this castle in 1995. It was a very impressive castle, and was one of the 15 castles that we visited. I'm enjoying the internet broadcasts, and as I've been a shortwave listener for many years, I must confess that listening by the internet is a lot better. I don't need an outside antenna and no ugly masts and no interference like one gets on shortwave.
And Stephen Hrabenach from the US writes,
"This is a follow-up to my comment over the weekend. I was thinking about your programming further and realized that not too long ago there was a story about changing the way you use music due to copyright restrictions with podcasts. Okay, it was longer than I thought. Looking it up, it was September 3rd. Perhaps I misunderstood that story or something has changed, but now I wonder how you can offer a program of music on Sundays given the potential copyright infringements. Nonetheless, I will be interested to hear an extended music feature."
The law only prohibits radio stations from making music available for download. We are allowed to stream it on the internet. So you can listen to the Sunday programs online, but they are not available as podcasts. John Covington from North Carolina in the United States also commented on the end of shortwave broadcasts.
"I just wanted to say how much I have enjoyed Radio Prague on shortwave over the years. I first listened to you in 1972, when I was 11 years old. I even had a QSL card from you, which unfortunately I've lost, from 1973, I think. I have maintained my interest in both shortwave and amateur radio ever since. I have listened to you many, many times over the years. I guess I have been listening to you for about half the time you've been on the air. Your programs were always interesting and your signals strong. I am sad to see Radio Prague leave shortwave, but I am glad I got to enjoy hearing you on the radio for the last 38 years. Thank you and best wishes to you."
While we mostly get positive comments regarding the contents of our broadcasts, there's no pleasing everybody, of course. For instance, Mark Winterton from somewhere in cyberspace is not happy with certain aspects of life in the Czech Republic, namely with the quality of translations, but also with Radio Prague broadcasts.
"Perhaps instead of pumping out endless propaganda about the Czech Republic, you and the other editors at Radio Prague could do what proper journalists do and produce some honest accounts of life in your country. I realise that you were brought up in the CSSR. However, the world has changed over the past two decades, even if you and the Czech Republic haven't changed very much."
That's the view of our reader or listener, Mark Winterton. What do you think? Is Radio Prague pumping out endless propaganda? Do you think that this country hasn't changed in the last 20 years? Do let us know here at Radio Prague 12099 Prague or English at radio.cz. By the way, the majority of Radio Prague's English section staff weren't even born or brought up in this country. We are out of time now, but before I sign off, let me repeat this month's quiz question. In February, we are looking for the name of the Czech scientist and explorer born in 1898 who took part in Roald Amundsen's expedition to the North Pole and survived the 1928 crash of airship Italia during an expedition led by Umberto Nobile. Your answers need to reach us by February the 28th. We'll be happy if you drop us a line and let us know how and where you listen to Radio Prague and what you think about our programs. QSL cards are still available to verify your reception reports. You can either use the form on our website at www.radio.cz/en/report or write to the usual addresses English at radio.cz or Radio Prague 12099 Prague. Mailbox will be back on March the 5th. Until then, stay faithful to Radio Prague.
Thank you, Pavla. Pavla Hrakova there with another edition of Mailbox. And do keep those letters coming. We are, of course, always interested in hearing from our listeners. Now, if you want to find out more about the long history of Czechs and Slovaks in the United States, the place to start is the National Czech and Slovak Museum and Library in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. The museum was devastated by floods in 2008, and some 6,000 flood-damaged volumes from the library are still being painstakingly restored. But the pace of recovery has been remarkably fast, and within the next couple of years, an ambitious project to rebuild and expand the museum should be complete. With it, the library will also be up and running once again. In Czech Books this week, David Vaughan finds out more about the library's rich collections.
The director of the museum in Cedar Rapids, Gail Norton, was in Prague at the beginning of September for a conference that brought together over 100 representatives of Czech emigre communities from across the world. She gave a vividly illustrated talk on the work being done to recover from the floods. Afterwards, I took the opportunity to ask her about the library and its history. To start with, I was intrigued to know how the foremost institution devoted to Czech and Slovak history and culture in the United States came to be in Cedar Rapids.
Lots of people ask that question. I think to go back a little, when the Czechs emigrated to the United States, they particularly came to the middle of the country. And up and down Illinois, of course, and Minnesota, Wisconsin, Iowa, Nebraska, all up and down into Texas. And when some people got together in Cedar Rapids to form a museum, it was just the right place. It was right in the center of all this.
And when was that?
Well, it was in the 1970s, and the National Museum came into being in the 1990s. And always, from the very first day in the 1970s, there was always a museum and a library.
And so tell me a little bit about the kind of books or other documents that you have collected in the library.
Well, at first, it was a lot of books that were in the Czech language, some in the Slovak language, that people had brought with them, that, of course, were being used less and less. The family didn't want to keep them. And that formed a core. But since that time, we have expanded a lot more and have a lot more personal papers, archival materials, photographs, maps, and periodicals from as many Czech and Slovak organizations in the United States as we can reach.
And how far back did these books and other documents and periodicals go?
I would say mostly from the 1800s through the 1900s. We have tried to focus on some key volumes today, but we focus mostly on historical reference material, family histories, histories of states and counties, and those kinds of things that are worthwhile for the future.
And can you give me some examples of the kind of material that you have that is particularly interesting?
Well, one example I can give you is we have a set of letters written by a man named Jan Pospisil. And this set of letters was written while he was on the battlefield fighting in the Civil War of the United States. He had been a new immigrant and had decided that this country was so worth sacrificing for that he went to war and wrote home in Czech, you know, to his family, giving the story of what it was like for a new American to fight in that Civil War. Really very interesting topic.
It must be quite moving as well, I should imagine.
Yes, although it's surprising sometimes when people write these things that they're very day-to-day, you know. But even that tells us a story.
And so your collection really must map very vividly the life of the early settlers who came to Mid-America from Bohemia, Moravia, Slovakia.
Yes, it does, but we are constantly still collecting these kinds of things. Families come to us from all over with family papers, family travel documents, correspondence. We try to collect, as I mentioned, organizational periodicals, newsletters, because those are fascinating, the things that people were doing, and from their social life to their more political life. In more recent years, we have a collection from the Czechoslovak National Council of America, which was an organization formed in 1918 that dissolved in about 2005. And in those early years of that organization, their purpose was to fight for the freedom of their homeland, and there were many fascinating things that they did. So it is not a cohesive story, but many pieces of a story from a lot of different voices, a lot of different angles.
In the course of the 20th century, I should imagine, the position of people of Czech and Slovak origin in the United States in relation to their homeland must have changed so dramatically as different regimes came and went. First, there was the First Republic, the democratic Czechoslovak state between the wars, then the Nazi occupation, then the 40 years of communist rule, and now, of course, the reopening of Czech society. This must be a very complicated, and I should imagine sometimes even quite difficult, relationship.
Well, it is, and we see all sorts of reactions. We have people who tell us when their family came, they might have been children or something, and that their parents wanted them to speak English, they wanted them to be American, and there's a whole generation in there that can't speak Czech. It has kind of skipped them because the family was so adamant that they needed to be American. And now we find them coming back and saying, I wish I knew the language better, and they learn the language. But then on the other hand, there are families who have stayed very closely in touch with their relatives and have continued to go back and forth through the years, not just after communism, but even during. So I suppose it goes back to the reason they came in the first place. You know, was it from some travail, some personal history with the government or something where they really wanted to get out of from under it? Or were there other reasons where they still stayed very close to home?
And what kind of people use your library and also visit the museum?
Well, it's a mix. There are people who, of course, are Czech and Slovak descent who want to come. They enjoy it. They tell us all the things we need to do, get right, and so forth. And then there are more serious researchers, and we have had people use the library for their research and will continue to do that. We have some general public who really are not Czech or Slovak. They're history aficionados, or they're just interested in history and culture, and they'll come for a temporary exhibition and then go through the more, you know, historical exhibition. So it's a wide range of people, really.
And is part of your task also to try and keep the Czech and Slovak cultural traditions alive?
It is, and we watch how many of the people who came in those early years came from the smaller villages, and they brought all of that culture with them. And I think even took that opportunity to celebrate the culture here that they were having a little more trouble at home doing. And so, yes, we do, but it becomes Americanized as well over the years, and we recognize that. So we also try to have authentic cultural activities from the Czech and Slovak republics and bring it over just as part of a process for people to learn how rich their culture is.
And has your work changed since the split of Czechoslovakia?
Not really. It was interesting, though, the timing of that was at the time this museum was changing, transforming from a more of a local museum to a national museum. And there was a very specific decision made that it would be Czech and Slovak. That before that, it had been Czechoslovak. And because it's really almost impossible to tell the story, the historical story of one without the other. They're so entwined through history under various regimes, and, you know, the language, while it's not the same, is closely related. So that was a very conscious decision in the 90s.
And of course, there are other elements as well. There's also the Jewish history of Czechoslovakia, the people who, in living in America, who were from German-speaking Bohemian families or Moravian families or Hungarian-speaking in Slovakia. That must be a slightly more complex legacy to deal with.
Well, it is. We have some correspondence among families that is in all three languages, just different members of the family and so forth. And we, I'll have to say, to this date, have not delved into those issues very deeply. But it is a very interesting history that really says a lot about the history of Europe and the history of the 20th century in particular, that we think there are many lessons to be learned for everyone from that experience.
I've noticed that the museum has a wonderful website, which is www.ncsml.org. This presumably, if people are interested in doing research into the history of Czechs and Slovaks in America, this is a good place to start, I should imagine.
Well, it is, although I would have to give the caveat at this point in time, because we went through a disaster in 2008. Our museum was flooded, and that included the library. We had removed many items before the flood, but not all. There wasn't time. And so we are in the process of recovery now. And so our library, we do not have a public face of the library at this point. Our director of the library fields questions and inquiries via email, and his email address can be found on our website. We had an online catalog of over 10,000 items, but that catalog is not active at this point in time. So we have some work ahead of us to get back to full-fledged library work here in the future.
And so when do you think you will be really back up and running as, well, business as usual?
Well, I, you know, in the long haul, it will be years. This was a very devastating hit for us. In the short term, though, we were building a new museum and library now. It will be opening in 2012, probably in mid-2012. And the library will have a public face then. We will be open, and more of our materials will be organized at that point. So we hope to get the online catalog back working.
Gail Norton, president of the National Czech and Slovak Museum and Library in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Best of luck with the future. Let's hope that the waters won't rise again in the next few years. And thank you very much indeed for talking to us at Radio Prague.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your interest, and we'll try to keep you updated.
That edition of Czech Books with David Vaughan with Gail Norton was first broadcast last November. And now David Vaughan stays with us for another edition of From the Archives.
In the 1930s, Prague was a modern city with a passion for innovation. New buildings were springing up, celebrating the technology of steel, chrome and glass. Jazz and swing were playing on the radio. And despite the impact of the world economic crisis, the Czech love of the motor car was growing fast. This led to a serious traffic problem. Here's a report from the 1st of January 1936 on the city's first ever traffic light. The intrepid reporter is standing at a busy Prague crossroads.
Hello, hello.
Hello, hello, he announces. We're at the big junction at Mustek at the bottom of Wenceslas Square. He goes on to describe a scene which must have seemed quite exotic to millions of Czechs and Slovaks listening in provincial towns and villages.
At small crossroads, the reporter explains, it's enough for a policeman to guide the traffic. But at big junctions like this, we have lights, red, yellow and green. Now the cars on the square are surging forwards. Yes, we have a green light. From today's perspective, the report sounds comic. But it's worth pointing out that this is an early example of an outside broadcast, an experiment in modern broadcasting. So we've seen that 1930s Prague was already full of traffic. Foreigners who visited Prague were often surprised by just how modern the city was. Here is an American professor who visited Prague with a study group in July 1937.
I spoke a moment ago of this city of Prague as being an old city, and yet in a very real sense we have found it to be a new city. The very day we arrived, we were impressed by it. To drive from our railroad station to our hotel, we passed through the archways of three towers dating back from the Middle Ages. We crossed the oldest stone bridge in Europe. We passed by the most famous clock, perhaps of all clocks in the world. And yet when we arrived in our hotel, we found the most modern furnishings, the most up-to-date equipment for the comfort, the most attractive beauty of our modern styles. So we have found that in this city there is a unique union of the beauty of an old world and the up-to-date, smart and attractive newness of the very best of modern life.
That was Professor Miller, an American visiting Prague in 1937, and judging from his enthusiasm, he clearly didn't get caught in one of those traffic jams.
Špičku nohy mají na plynu, pozor, pozor, zelená.
From the Archives with David Vaughan brings us just about to the end of today's program, but just a quick reminder, if you'd like more Czech stories and news, please do visit us on the web. Our address is radio.cz. We're going to leave you now with Bedřich Smetana's Vltava, part of his symphonic poem, Má vlast.
Thank you. Vous écoutez Radio Prague, la diffusion de nos programmes va...